Welcome to season two of the Fresh Flow podcast. Mitchell, right off the bat, just tell me, did you think we'd make it this far?
No. That truth, honest truth right there.
Thank you for being so candid.
And this is why I think our guest decided to show up on season two instead of season one. So,
so you're saying that our guest didn't think we would make it this far either?
You know, he was hedging his bets. He's a smart man.
Smart guy. All right. Well, that's a perfect segue. Let's get going. I have the pleasure of welcoming my boss here today, and actually the guy who we should give a lot of credit for this podcast existing. So today we have with us Dr. Dan Berkowitz, the chair of anesthesiology here at UAB. Dan, welcome in, man.
You know, considering the eminent folks that have been on your podcast previously, I feel pretty humbled to be here. So thank you for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to this. Should be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And thank you for supporting us. This was a crazy idea, gosh, a year ago or more. And just like you frequently do when I come with crazy ideas, you go, yeah, man, sounds good. Let's do it. So
I've given you a long rope and you haven't hung yourself yet, man. Well,
so, give it time. Well, let's dive into your background. You're a clinical anesthesiologist for sure, working in the operating rooms, but an extensive research background coming to us from Baltimore, leading that effort at Johns Hopkins. Tell us about that, your history and research, and then how you feel that that kind of prepared you for this next step, which is taking on a position of a chair at an academic program like this.
Sure. Well, I kind of emerged into my research career at the time of the explosion of the molecular medicine. And I'd always been interested in molecular medicine. I did a fellowship in human genetics after my internship. But more importantly, I was very, very fortunate to have had a visionary chair in the Department of Anesthesia when I did my training at Duke. And Duke was kind of emerging as a pretty highly well-respected academic Department of Anesthesia at that time, just emerging. And Dr. Reeves, Jerry Reeves, at that time realized the importance of anesthesiology research training, true training, like other specialties. And he had sent some of his fellows. One of them was Dr. Deborah Schwinn, who subsequently became a chair and then ultimately went on to be a dean, to the lab of Dr. Lefkowitz, who ultimately in 2014 won the Nobel Prize for G-protein coupled receptors. And so he really understood the importance of anesthesiologists doing fundamental basic research so that we could really lead in science and in academia and really be players. So I was fortunate to be able to work with Dr. Schwinn, and that was really the beginning of my academic career. I was able to get a fair grant with her on molecular mechanisms of alpha-1 adrenergic signaling. And ultimately, a lot of that work on adrenergic receptor subtypes led to the development of some very important drugs that all of us will use as we get older. One of them is Flomax, okay? Because understanding the... Unfortunately, we will be using it. Understanding the alpha-1 adrenergic receptor C subtype and targeting drugs to that was kind of the original fundamental work that we were actually doing in the lab. So when I went to Hopkins, I actually was a little bit of a mentorless for a while, and then I found myself associated with the Department of Biomedical Engineering with Art Shukas. Art actually was one of the folks who worked with Suga and Sagawa defining the pressure volume loop. So, you know, the fundamental pressure volume loops that we know in the heart, that work was all done in Sagawa's lab. And Dr. Shukas was a venous biologist, and I came with molecular with some molecular skills. And so we were able to work together, and I was able to establish a vascular biology lab. And my focus in the vascular biology lab was really the role of nitric oxide and its role and dysregulation in disease processes, particularly vascular stiffness and aging, which is what I got my first R01 grant on. And then we did work on atherogenesis, some pulmonary hypertension work. And then I actually did work with NASA, in which we worked on both understanding the molecular mechanisms of orthostatic intolerance in astronauts and also the endothelial dysfunction associated with radiation, with deep space radiation. So I was funded through NASA. And I probably not many people know that I actually had a project on board STS-107. STS-107 was the shuttle Columbia. It was at the landing site. So we had a lab set up. We had rats on the shuttle. And unfortunately, we know what happened with STS-107. I was waiting in the stands for Columbia to land. And unfortunately, it fell apart, broke apart over Texas. And unfortunately, we had no data from that. But obviously, it was much more of a disaster than that. So what I fundamentally found about research is, number one, discovery is so important in terms of the scientific process for our specialty, in terms of idea generation, problem solving. But when I speak to new candidates and new fellows, new residents, and try and entice them to go to an academic career and do research, what I say to them is the most important thing is you will meet interesting people and you will go to interesting places and it'll broaden your horizons and make you less judgmental and it'll just make your life interesting. And so that's really what it's done for me. And it's allowed me to frame what I think might be important pathways for progress in our specialty. And those have obviously changed. But I've actually been very, very fortunate in that the institution was generous. I was able to establish a lab now here. It's been very exciting. We've transitioned a little bit to work in the area of endothelial function and preeclampsia. And that's been a fun academic exercise. And it's really what it's enabled me to do is to actually bring in our clinicians with our basic scientists to come together and solve important problems and come up with new potential new therapies and new ideas about mechanisms. So that's my research trajectory and track.
Dan, I just want to echo what you said through your research career that you know that as a specialty, we need to lead. And then what I want to do is I want to pivot, right? You started as chair at the University of Alabama, and then you sort of had to pivot with the pandemic, right? And so now that you're on the other side, you're an administrator, you're in charge of a department. Has it gotten harder or easier to sort of push that research mission?
I mean, I think that's a good question. I think what it's been, I would say easier. And I'll tell you why it's been easier. I've been able to acquire, number one, the resources and being able to channel them in the directions that I think are the most valuable for our specialty. And so that's entailed making bets. It's entailed investing in people that I feel are going to be successful. And my strategy for success in our department has been twofold. What I've tried to do is to find folks that are just on the cusp of success. These are young folks that are doing good cutting-edge research, haven't quite gotten to independence, but are getting there, have either had foundation funding and are in the process of writing a grant. So those are the folks that I think are worth investing. And actually, we've been pretty successful in that domain in terms of having people funded and doing their interesting work. We've also had the strategy of recruiting more seasoned investigators. That's an expensive proposition, but it's worthwhile. And I've been fortunate to have some of the resources to be able to do that. You know, I think we've also made some investments in health services research and in AI, as we're going to potentially, hopefully, we'll talk a little bit about later, because I think those are areas in which I think our profession can really lead, particularly as it pertains to things like precision and predictive medicine and predictive perioperative medicine, particularly. So I think it's been easier just because I've had the ability to make the decisions myself and to create a team myself and not really be behooven to someone else's vision. I can be behooven to my own vision, which is much more fun.
We've discussed this too, Dan, just the academic anesthesiology, right? And what we need to do as a specialty across the country, building networks. And, you know, you are one of those individuals out there that sort of sees our specialty just not only within your department or across your department, but sort of across the country, maybe the world.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we've, like I say, Mitch, we've been a beneficiary of both your and other people's great insights and intellect and ideas. as adjunct faculty. And you're right, we really need to create a much greater community of anesthesia thinkers and researchers and idea generators. So yeah.
Or at a minimum for Matt to make fun of me on each of these podcasts.
Really, really my goal every time. My goal every time is to get a good jab in on Mitch. And if I do, I'm happy. So Dan, you mentioned your vision. You mentioned AI. The three of us were involved in an article on the infinite game, and we kind of used that as a framework to discuss the future of our specialty. What are some of those things from your perspective that are worth investing in? Where should we be putting our time and energy for the future of anesthesiology?
Well, I think that number one, when we talk about sort of the infinite game, I really think that we need to see our specialty through the lens of, actually in our department, we've done that as almost a third component of the organizational structure. You know, we think about our organizational structure. I like to think about it in the terms of Senec's framework. What are the things that are important for our specialty? Well, having a sustainable, nimble organization, because we live in a world that moves so fast, that's changing so fast. We have to have that existential flexibility. We need to flex quickly. We need to be able to change. The most important thing for a healthy organization, again, is to have great trusting teams. I mean, that's, as you know, trusting teams are what creates an environment where people enjoy coming to work and enjoy the work they do. We need to have courage to say, look, the way we've done things in the past has not served us well. We can't fight with our CRNA colleagues. We need to create teams where everyone's contributions are valued in the same way. And ultimately, that's the only way we can build and create value in our specialty. And I think that this value proposition for our specialty, I don't have the answers. I don't have all the answers, but I really think we need to so fundamentally change the way we think about our specialty and what it is that we actually do. I know what we do. I mean, I think that number one, we are a data-driven specialty. We have more data than any other specialty. We have the ability to actually access, process that data. And so that's one of the areas that I think we really need to leverage for our specialty. And that is precision medicine, predictive medicine. I think what's important as well, and something that is important from the context of our specialty, is that we need to ensure that as we pivot and create value, we actually train our residents in these new technologies, in these new techniques, so that we're not trying to teach them the same things that they were learning, you know, 30 years ago as the primary focus of our specialty, but that they understand our value in some of these new ideas.
I'm just going to add, you know, we've had an informal book group over the last couple of years. And the most recent one that you've thrown out at us is Thank You for Being Late by Thomas Friedman, right? And in this book, Friedman talks of the story of Edward Teller and how AI and sort of the technology that we're living in right now is exponential, and the human brain has evolved for linear growth, right? So we're struggling with this gap, and you mentioned that we need to train people differently. Friedman points out that we need to, the curricula in colleges and undergraduates are going to become non-existent or useless in 5 years, right? And medicine has not kept up with that pace of change, right? And so I fully agree with you. How do we pivot as academic anesthesiologists to ensure that our future anesthesiologists are able to compete, right? Because if we're going to compete on the dollar and the value proposition, I think ultimately in 10 years, we're not going to win.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I think that's our challenge. I think it's a tough one, but I think therein lies our challenge. What that also brings to the fore is that actually what we need to do in our departments is create a much greater diversity of thinking of people within our department. You know, we primarily now, we recruit clinicians and physicians. And maybe what we need to be doing is having within our department, you know, systems engineers. Maybe we need to have, and hopefully we do and can, we have AI experts. we're very fortunate in our department to have a very robust IT department. So that helps us. But like you say, if we're going to address the issues, the problems, if we're going to grow in this technologically accelerating environment, we're going to have to play with the big boys. I mean, ultimately, otherwise we're going to get lost. We all will be lost.
I just want to point out that, you know, when Michael Porter came out with his value-based healthcare platform from the Harvard Business School, one of them was that you needed an infrastructure, right? For the data management, all the systems that you need to keep a business going. And, you know, Harvey Cushing, neurosurgeon, father of the anesthetic record, right? He understood it back then. And I think that the opportunity for our specialty is, even with MPOG, right, you're looking at data in the past to try to predict the future, right? But with your background in molecular medicine, genomic medicine, precision medicine, how do we actually get to the point where the patient that comes in, we know what anti-nausea medication to use, right? I think that is a huge opportunity that we sort of haven't really looked at.
Wait, do we have more than one nausea medication?
Well, if you're in Vermont, you sort of give what the pharmacy orders for you. But, you know, I think Tongan said you just, if the first one didn't work, just keep throwing them on.
Just as a side note, because my office at Hopkins was right next to Henry Brems, the chair of neurosurgery, and they have a panel, like a board for each of the chairs that they've had of neurosurgery. And I used to walk past. They had one for Harvey Cushing, and I used to walk past pretty much every day. It's just a side note. So,
yep, we should give indeed. Him an honorary chair position in anesthesiology.
I understand what Mitch is saying. What I think is that the integration of all of this data is going to happen very soon. I would say that the only barrier right now to integration of all of the information that you're talking about is health privacy. I think that the large language models that we have now are absolutely perfectly capable of integrating all of this information and throwing it out. We know that they can go through current drugs and find uses for new therapies. I mean, these large language models can go through billions of references and can scan the whole of PubMed in no time. So the only thing that I think we're missing for integrating that is the ability to actually put this data out there. I mean, I think once we can actually put patient data out or have it within being able to scan it in these large language models, I think that's the only limitation, quite frankly, right now. I think a lot of us are playing with these models and with these languages, language like Perplexity. They are just incredible in what they can actually do. The deep fundamental research that they can actually do is beyond anything that one can imagine. So I think we're at the point where we will be able to do those things. We will be able to do the precision assessment of patients' data that'll actually be able to direct therapy and care in a way that we've never been able to do in the past.
Yeah, so Dan, a bit of a pivot here and a bit of a risk because I'm going to go off script a little bit. Do you really want to do that when you're talking to your boss? But I'm going to try it anyway. I've heard you mention a few times this diversity of thought. I heard you mention earlier this kind of more inclusive approach to our teams, moving away from the conflict in our teams. And I have to think that your background plays a little bit into that. You're a proud South African. You sent Mitch and I some really wicked pictures from your adventures in South Africa here recently. You're a braver man than I am. I am not a hang glider, and I'm not going to be a hang glider, but you are. Has your South African upbringing influenced who you are in a way that maybe we see here as in your leadership style?
That's a really good question, actually, and I'm glad you asked it. What I'll say is this, that I grew up sort of a humble-ish guy in Johannesburg, and never in my wildest imagination would I have ever thought that I would have the opportunities that I have in my life now. And so I'm so grateful that I've been able to do the things that I've done and the opportunities that have been given to me. And I think there are certain characteristics of growing up in South Africa. South Africans, in some way, we were never told how to sell ourselves. We kind of just got on with doing what we had to do, which I think is helpful to some degree. I will tell you, I grew up in the height of apartheid in South Africa, and I think that influenced me a lot. I saw a lot of suffering and I saw a lot of injustice. And I think part of the reason I left is that I didn't want to continue to be a part of that injustice. And so I think that helps me to frame perhaps the love of diversity and inclusivity. And I don't know, but I hope that drives some of that. Again, I think most of it comes from the idea and from the feeling of tremendous gratitude that I've had opportunities that I really would never have even dreamt of as a kid growing up in South Africa. And so I think that sort of drives my enthusiasm, my optimism. And I think that it's the optimism that I really like and enjoy. And I enjoy both you and Mitch, and that's why I think we get on so well.
You know, you're finishing up, I believe, the first 5 years as chair. I could be wrong or a little bit off here. You're on to your
Six.
So you're on to your second fifth, right? Alex Macario at Stanford. He's now the president of the American Board of Anesthesiology. But, he's made a comment to me that if you're not doing something different every 5 years, you're doing something wrong, Mitch, right? So another 5 years or another 5 years after that, what's the legacy for Dr. Dan Berkowitz?
I think about that a lot. I wanted to say that I think one of the advantages that I have as a chair is my trajectory to chair was never straightforward. And it wasn't like I had that in my sights from day one. I'm essentially an older chair. I became chair at 58, which is on the older side for becoming a chair. So, and also I have the advantage of, at this point, not really having the chair as a stepping stone to the next thing. I don't really have the next thing. So this is my thing right now, which I think it's good because I don't have to kind of worry about being all that politically savvy, although I guess I do have to be politically savvy to some degree. So I think in terms of my legacy, I think the two important things that you, Mitch, have discussed this, and Matt sort of framed this pretty well for me. In fact, I think his wife came up with this.
She did.
The two things are the infinite anesthesia, which is really the humanism and understanding how we can continue to sustain an organization, sustain the department using all of the Cynic principles. So that would be the infinite anesthesia, the IA. And then the AI, which is kind of the scientific future of our specialty, AI, and hopefully that component, having built a little bit of a data science group, having hopefully implemented some AI infrastructure within the department, and hopefully it infiltrating all of the different components, whether it's education, research, even operations, will be sort of hopefully the legacy for the department. And, I don't know. I don't know what the next journey is. I've been very fortunate. I recruited when I came, one of my scientists in the department, Dr. Anika, he had developed a new technology for generating inhaled nitric oxide, and he's commercialized that. So there's something on the horizon, hopefully there. I don't know where I'm going next, but I know I'm staying here for a while and I'm going to enjoy what I do here and build on some of the things that we've already started to do. So,
well, if you don't know what your next gig is, I've got your next gig for you. You're going to be one of Simon Sinek's optimists. He has a team of optimists.
Is that right? Are you serious?
He does indeed.
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
I'm going to find a way to nominate you because that's cool. Being a member of this department, you've been through some rough stuff, man. You walked in right before a global pandemic, and it was not easy, but you have stayed positive and optimistic throughout. So we appreciate your support, not only as faculty members, but of this podcast and of all the crazy, crazy ideas that we've had. So, Mitchell, anything else you want to get to before we get done?
No, I think a couple of weeks ago, I sent you guys a Harvard Business Review article, Abandon Stocks and Embrace Flows. Academic medicine has always built itself on the ivory towers, right? We own a stock of knowledge that nobody else is going to teach you except us. And, from a chair who's come from not small institutions, right? Duke, Johns Hopkins, it's nice to see an individual who believes that democratizing the information that we have as a specialty is actually going to take us to a higher realm. So kudos to you, Dr. Berkowitz.
Thanks, Mitch. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed reading that, by the way. It's really...
Yeah, it was good. It was really great. Good.
It's really good.
Probably at 2 a.m. in the morning, right?
He may have read it at 2 a.m. in the morning. There is one thing that I am doing at 2 a.m. in the morning, and that is REM sleep. So I am not a night owl like Dr. Berkowitz is. So, well, Dan, thank you. Thank you for doing this with us. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting us. And thank you for season two of Fresh Flow Podcast. This is going to be a blast. And we promise that we will do our best and not let you down.
Guys, this was the best. I haven't had this much fun in a while. So it's awesome. Except, I guess, jumping off a mountain with a paragliding. I guess that was fun. But anyway.
You're a wild man. You're a wild man. All right.
See you guys.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you guys tuning in to this edition of the Fresh Flow Podcast. We'll catch you on the next one.